Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to the Pinnacle Performance Podcast. Today, I have Evan Pikin for you all, and this was a fantastic podcast. I really enjoyed it. Evan was phenomenal, and there's a lot of practically applicable information, and I feel like sometimes podcasts don't necessarily have that. So I think this is just a really good overview of his model, how he uses the principles in his model, and how you can start to think about using those principles for your own clients and athletes. I hope you enjoy.
All right, just for people that might not be familiar with your work, can you just give a general overview on you?
Yeah, of course. So depending on what day of the week we chat, I wear a few different hats. So I'm a coach, physiologist, researcher. So I kind of bounce between those three different disciplines. But in general, I coach CrossFit athletes. I work with people all the way from a recreational level up to a games level or games competitor level. And I'm also a physiologist and researcher. Most of my research involves near-infrared spectroscopy, which I know we'll chat about a little bit today. And I'm also personally interested in mathematically modeling performance and fatigue in athletes as well.
Nice. Yeah, I've been following you for quite some time. I took your course, and honestly, like, it was one of the coolest things I've ever done in terms of continuing education. Totally changed my whole perspective in terms of sort of how energy system development truly works. And I mean, I recommend anyone check it out. But in terms of this campaign that you've been launching, this Kickstarter, from what I understand, you guys are trying to create a portal, sort of like an app that integrates with the Moxie device.
Yeah, for sure. So up until now, Moxie has been a hardware. So if someone buys a Moxie monitor, it's a little device they could pop on a working muscle. But the difficulty in getting people to implement that technology is that there's no really good software solutions right now. You buy a Moxie, you get this nice piece of hardware, and then you have to look for a third-party app or software to integrate your data. And none of those platforms are really made for a Moxie monitor specifically. So as a coach or a researcher, I've never been able to find something that I'm like, yeah, this is the shit. Like, this gets everything that I want. So what I've done is partnered with Moxie Monitor, the company, and we're essentially building out a mobile application for Android and iPhones to make data collection really seamless. Right now, you have to lug a laptop into the gym, and it's just this whole pain in the ass process. And then subsequently, we're also building out a data analysis platform. So a lot of people that are like the Moxie power users, we like code spreadsheets and we build out all these calculators to crunch our data. It's not very practical. So we want to make this whole process as easy and seamless as possible. So the average coach doesn't need to go and read a biochemistry textbook and learn statistics to interpret the data. They could just do it very easily.
Yeah, I think that was the most intimidating thing for me too. Like, after taking your course, I was like, man, this is really cool. I really want to get my hands on a Moxie or 2 or 3. And it got to the point where I was like, oh man, but how am I going to interpret the data? You know, like, it's COVID. How am I going to like put my hands on people and all that stuff? So knowing that this is coming out is really, really cool. Is there like a specific deadline you're trying to hit for when it's released?
Yeah, so it's going to come out in a few different stages. So there's going to be like beta test versions along the way. For people that are backing the Kickstarter campaign, I think we're going to be getting them the first beta test copy of the software and app by maybe May or June, which is software development. So I wish I could say it's in a week or two from now. Things take a little bit of time. And then we're looking for early fall to have the whole platform rolled out and ready to go.
That's awesome. So I wanted to talk about a little bit of the practical application of that stuff. And then also like the practical application, not actually having a Moxie device. Because most people don't at the end of the day, but in terms of using the Moxie device, like let's say I have this app and let's say that I want to use it with, I don't know, like a running athlete, a distance runner. How could I use that along with the app in like real time to get the data that I'm looking for that will help me make informed decisions on this person?
Yeah, for sure. So the way that I was explaining it, there's a few different categories of ways that we could use Moxie. And I think of it like a cloud of all these different applications, and some of them are overlapping. So some people use Moxie and the only thing they use it for is testing and assessing athletes. That's definitely an application that you could use for a runner. I know I come from a middle distance running background. So back when I was competing, like the testing that we all did was VO2 max testing and blood lactate testing. And those tests are great. They allow you to quantify performance, to understand, they give you some data to understand why an athlete's fatiguing, but they don't do anything practical from a training standpoint. Like even as a coach, I'll have an athlete go to a lab and they're like, hey coach, my VO2 max is 70 milliliters per kilogram per minute. What do we do with this?
Right.
I'm like, one, it's a great VO2 max. Congratulations. Two, we do nothing with that whatsoever because we don't know why that's your VO2 max. I care less about the number. Of course, I want to see it go up over time, but I want to know, why isn't your VO2 max 72 milliliters per kilogram, or why isn't it 74? That's what's going to be more actionable for us. And that's something that Moxie allows us to do. So we could think in terms of rate limiting factors for VO2 max. If you conceptualize VO2 max as the maximum integrated capacity of your pulmonary, cardiovascular, and muscular system to uptake, transport, and utilize oxygen, we could say which of those three processes is occurring the slowest for you and acting as a rate limiter. So we could identify that with relative ease. We could do that in about an hour for most athletes. We could also use it for individualizing your training session. So this is what I always say is, when things are going well, it's not a useful device, but this allows us to troubleshoot things when they don't go well. So if I write, I'm making a workout up right now, you're going to do 16 by 400 meter repeats at 65 seconds a clip with a minute between. When I'm writing that workout, unless I'm completely making stuff up, I have to have some preconceived notions about what adaptation I want you to get from that workout. And when things are going well, you're going to get that adaptation and it's groovy. We don't need to change anything. But what happens if you come in on that day and I see your tissues not utilizing oxygen well, or your coordination is a little bit off relative to where you're at baseline? As a coach, do I just tell you to do that workout anyway? And I'm like, well, I don't care that your tissue can't utilize oxygen. Just do it anyway, because the toughest athlete wins, right? Yeah. Or what I could do is say, okay, well, what can you do today? Like, could we modify this workout so you could get the same stimulus with a little bit different constraints? You're at a point where you're just not going to do any productive training at all today. And in that case, we could create some kind of restoration for you. That same logic could be applied for strength training. We could even use it for load management, seeing how much of a beating could your tissues take in a single day or a single week or a single month. So there's a lot of different applications. Some Moxie users will hone in on one of those and they don't care about any of those other applications. Some people kind of pick and choose based on their own clients or demographics. So it's a very broad technology, I think.
Mm-hmm. How would you use it for strength training and seeing how, like, okay, for example, let's use the example you just used. How would you be able to determine based off of the data that this might not be the best day for you to go heavy, or maybe like over the course of a month, we've determined that this is how much load you can use?
Yeah, for sure. So imagine you come in, you're like, I want to get my lateral delts jacked. Like, that's your only training goal for some reason. You want to like look super wide. And we put a Moxie on your lateral delts. And I'm like, hey, take this set of lateral raises to complete failure. And you go and you take it to failure. And I'm looking at your trends and I'm like, all right, when's his muscle oxygen saturation going to go down? And you finish your set and I'm like, huh, that's weird. Nothing happened. Well, if you just took that set of lateral delts to failure and nothing happened that we're picking up on the device, it means you probably weren't using your lateral delts to do that exercise. So this is where I'd say, okay, well, maybe it's just the shitty exercise. Like, there's no reason why your lateral delts would be the limiting factor on that movement. You're like using some weird hand position. You're kind of like jostling your torso around to move the weight. Some people do weird things like that. It might be that for you, you're stuck in thoracic extensions. I know this is something I've heard you talk about. You use a lot of the respiration pieces and kind of like manipulating people's thorax and pelvis. Imagine you have that person come in that's in that like that Superman posture. Their chest is up. They have a deep anterior pelvic tilt. Well, they're not going to use their lateral delts, because when your axial skeleton is in that position, you're going to have inhibition in the lateral delts. So for that person, we need to work on their position first. Maybe they have weak expiratory muscles and that's why they're stuck in thoracic extension, or maybe it's tied to their breathing mechanics. Whatever it is, get them on the table, fix that issue. Then over time, you could actually have them isolate and train their lateral delts. And for other people, it could be that they have sub-recruitment in that tissue, or maybe they had a shoulder surgery and the normal fiber structure is disrupted and that's impairing their utilization of that tissue. We don't really know just at face value, but the Moxie allows us to parse those things out. So rather than saying like, hey, this guy's lateral delts won't grow, let's just double his training volume and blow his labrum out. Instead, we could see, okay, well, is it fundamentally an issue with the tissue? And if that's the case, more volume, more intensity, more density, those things aren't going to get us the adaptation. So it really just allows us to ask better questions and understand why things aren't working the way that we want them to. If someone's lateral delts are getting jacked and they're doing five sets of lateral raises a week, I'm not doing anything for them. I'm not going to tell them anything they don't already know.
Yeah. So it still requires like the coach to have like a holistic skill set. You can't just plug a Moxie device on someone and automatically have the answers, but it's going to give you an indication as to what could potentially be going on with in terms of how the muscle is actually being recruited and used. And then it's up to the coach. It's like, okay, is this like a position problem or is this, you know, a past injury or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, for sure. It's not at the point yet that it's just point and click and you know exactly what limitations are. You still have to play a little bit of detective. The way that I explain it is understanding how to read Moxie trends is like learning a new language. Within a few hours, I could teach someone a few basic sentences in Greek and I could tell them how to ask a waiter where the bathroom is. But imagine they go to the restaurant and they ask the waiter where the bathroom is in Greek and the waiter responds in a way that they've never heard me explain. They're like, oh, shit, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Moxie is similar. You could teach someone basic pattern recognition. They could spot some trends on their own, but they need to learn a little bit more grammar, syntax, and vocabulary to really make use of the device.
That's a really good metaphor. I like that. And just like anything else that's useful, you need to really spend time getting to know it. One thing I'm glad you brought up was the respiratory limitations. And I think that ties in really well with the audience that listens to this podcast and also just my own interests. I'm someone who's really interested in how the biomechanics of someone's axial skeleton can affect the outcomes in energy system training. So can you just give a brief overview about respiratory limitations, how they affect the oxygen being delivered, utilized, and potentially just how it overall affects a training stimulus?
Yeah, for sure. And what's kind of funny, I think we probably both came to the topic of respiratory limitations through a different place. Like I've listened to some of your podcasts and I know you have a movement background, you're interested in biomechanics. When I was learning about physiology, I wanted to know as little biomechanics as possible. Like I've just never liked biomechanics. It's never been interesting. So I intentionally like pushed that under the table. And I found that I had to end up coming back around to biomechanics because I was spotting these respiratory limitations in athletes' physiology. And I'm like, shit, I need to go back into biomechanics. I don't want to do this. So from my perspective, obviously, I definitely don't know as much about the mechanics of like the rib cage and all these things as you do. So maybe you could jump in and tell me that some of my explanations are a little bit whack. But the way that I think about it, there's a few different types of respiratory limitations that we can look at. I think of them in terms of structural limitations and functional limitations. If we're starting with structural limitations, like we talked about, if someone's already stuck in thoracic extension, they're coming into the step test, I already know that they're going to present with a respiratory limitation. If you're stuck in thoracic extension, your diaphragm's not going to vertically expand during respiration or during expiration rather. So I know you're going to present with an expiratory muscle issue. And the way that I see that present when I'm using Moxie or some other technologies is you're not going to be able to expel CO2 effectively. So when you're getting deeper and deeper into these workouts, CO2 is going to be accumulating and you're not able to breathe that out because you don't have the expiratory muscle development. So as a result of that, you get a CO2 buildup, you cause a right shift in the oxygen dissociation curve and hemoglobin dissociates from oxygen too readily and you end up desaturating a muscle. And if you keep going for long enough and you're fatiguing the respiratory system, you'll get what's called a metaboreflex that kicks in, which is a form of sympathetic vasoconstriction. You could essentially think about it, your brain cutting off blood flow to your locomotor muscles to protect your diaphragm. That's one of the things that we could see happen. But even in the highest level endurance athletes, we see a different form of respiratory limitation. That's called a pulmonary diffusion limitation. What's really odd, if we look at the body as a system of systems, the body's typically very good at adapting to the demands of exercise, like your cardiovascular system adapts, the muscular system obviously adapts. It's something you could physically see. So logically, we would assume that the respiratory system adapts to exercise effectively as well. One of the really strange things is that in some ways, the respiratory system is really underbuilt for the demands of maximal exercise. Some portions of the pulmonary system are actually damaged by maximal effort exercise, like the conducting airways. And in elite athletes, our chest wall structurally limits how much the pulmonary system could adapt. So what you see is in the highest level endurance athletes, they develop what's called a pulmonary diffusion limitation. So essentially their stroke volume and their heart rate get so high, so their cardiac output increases so much that it pushes the red blood cells through their pulmonary capillaries so quick that they don't have time to pick up oxygen in the pulmonary capillaries. So they start circulating deoxygenated blood around their body. And what happens is their arteries have low oxygen in them. Your blood goes through the arteries into the capillaries and then into the veins and back to the heart. So by the time this blood's getting to the capillaries and the muscles, it's already deoxygenated. Now the brain's not getting enough oxygen, the heart's not getting enough oxygen, and the respiratory system's not getting enough oxygen. As a result of that, your brain's going to trigger a series of protective effects because your heart, your brain, your respiratory system, those are way more important than your biceps, your quads. So it triggers this whole cascade of events that causes these athletes to get tingling in their fingers and toes. Sometimes their hands and feet will go numb. You'll see their lips turn blue. So there's tons, like respiratory limitations is a whole world of insane events that play out.
That's really interesting. You wouldn't see like what you just described. That is more of an elite athlete thing, or would you see that in, you could see it anywhere?
It's typically more of an elite athlete thing. And I think part of that is that the average person just isn't going to push themselves that hard, or it's two portions rather. One, they're not going to push themselves that hard. Also, their stroke volume and cardiac output aren't high enough to make that happen. So it's a combination of the fact that these elite athletes, they have fantastic stroke volume. That's one of the biggest things that determines an elite athlete from average Joe who runs 5Ks on the weekend. But the second thing is elite athletes' pain tolerance is so much better than the average person. So if you have a dude who happens to run a few times a week and somehow he's blessed with the cardiovascular system of elite endurance athlete, but he stops running hard when he's starting to get pain, he's not going to push to that point. But these elite athletes, they're experiencing the pain, but they're able to push through it for long enough periods that they actually put themselves in danger. And that's where you see these like central governor mediated effects actually kicking in, where they're getting blood flow shunted away from their extremity muscles and you get their fingers and hands going numb.
But David Goggins is like a perfect example of that.
Yeah, someone like that is probably the example that is so extreme that it's detrimental to their own health. Like the people that I come from a track and field and cross country background. Like if you watch D1 cross country, every year people black out a few feet in front of the finish line because they literally just run so hard. They get that arterial desaturation and they keep going. And if your brain doesn't get enough oxygen, the lights just go out. So you do see things like that happen in elite sport.
Mm-hmm. So if you had someone that has these respiratory, other than improving their breathing mechanics and biomechanics, what could you do in terms of just creating a training session to help cater to their needs?
Yeah, so if we wanted to get into like the tech side, you could use certain respiratory trainers like Spiro Tiger or P100. It's really the only two devices that come to mind on the market that allow you to train the strength of your respiratory muscles, whether that's your inspiratory or expiratory muscles, depending on which are weaker, the endurance of those respiratory muscles, and then also the breathing coordination is a big one. What makes those devices really unique is they allow you to rebreathe your own CO2 and they regulate your CO2 levels so you don't get your CO2 so high and then you black out while you're using the device, or your CO2 levels get so low that that becomes problematic as well. That's one way to do it. It's probably the easiest way. One of the ways that I like for people who don't want to use technology would be something called like a hard start training interval. So if we were to use like the most generic example, let's say you would have an athlete hop on a Concept 2 rower and they were to do 500 meter repeats at their 2K pace. So let's say the athlete has a 7 minute 2K, that would be 500 meter repeats at a 145 pace. It's a nice interval structure. It's pretty traditional, but that's not going to create a lot of respiratory system stress. Imagine now we create an interval structure where we do say 125 meters at a 141 pace, a 144 pace, a 149, something a little higher. I can't do the math off the top of my head, but we want it to average out to a 145. Yeah. Essentially, you're starting out very fast and slowing down across the interval. What that's going to allow you to do is reach a very high percentage of your peak oxygen consumption early into the interval. Mm-hmm. By slowing down across that interval, you're going to be able to sustain a high percent of peak O2 consumption and a high percentage of your VO2 peak. And that's going to create a lot of respiratory system stress. So even though on paper, both intervals average out to a 500 meter at a 145 split, one of those is the more traditional interval structure. And the other one is biased towards stimulating the pulmonary system or respiratory system. So it's simple interventions like that, where we don't need to like overhaul an athlete's training completely. You could take the work that they're already doing and just manipulate the intraset pacing structures in order to bias one system or the other.
I really like that. Yeah, that's. I think that was a great explanation too. So is there like a specific, if we were to determine the pace, is there like a specific way someone who doesn't have technology, is there like a percent or is there a way we can determine like this is a good place to start these people with respiratory limitations and then adjust from there?
Yeah, so if you think someone has a respiratory limitation, what I would first start with is structure, make sure the position of the axial skeleton is in check, then make sure they have good breathing mechanics. So kind of covering some of those fundamentals, like don't throw them into hard start intervals if like they look like a human cashew hunched over and they don't know how to breathe properly, it's not going to get you what you're looking for. But assuming we check all those different boxes, I think a really conservative way to start it would be something like a 500 meter repeat, starting roughly 5 to 6 seconds faster than their 2K pace and finishing the interval roughly 5 to 6 seconds slower. So you could even create like a gradual pacing spectrum across that, like mathematically average it out so you're slowing down at an even rate. And just see how that goes for someone compared to a normal straight pace 500 meter row interval. Some athletes, you give them that, like they could do the 500 meter at a 145 pace this week and they do 8 sets and they're fine. But then you tweak that pacing structure and you give it to them the next week. If they are someone who's respiratory limited, sometimes they do 2 or 3 sets and they're like, dude, I'm tapping out, like that wrecked me, and they're suffocating. Yeah. So I think there's more aggressive things than we could do with that, but that's where I would start. And if that doesn't hit someone hard, then you could push the pace a little bit harder on the front end and play around with those pace manipulations.
Would that apply to longer duration as well in terms of like longer intervals?
Yeah, you could definitely take the interval duration up. I typically start short there. And the reason for that is a lot of athletes don't have great breathing coordination. So when they start getting to these very high respiratory rates, they just can't coordinate their breathing. So I find for athletes who haven't done a lot of this style of training, if they hit 35, 40 breaths per minute, their breathing coordination just goes out the window. So sometimes if you start them with like a 5 or 10 minute interval in that style, coordination just goes out the window 2-3 minutes in, and then they just like breathe through their chest and suffocate themselves the rest of the time. So I'm always careful to not overdose people early into the process.
Yeah, I actually really know what you mean. Ever since I took your course, I've been messing around with this stuff a lot. And I remember you gave me one training session for respiratory limitation. Was you would have them, I forget what the interval pace is, but you would have them do something, and then you would get them in a quadruped position, and then you would have them control their breathing because, you know, they're probably starting to compensate through their breathing mechanics. So what I would tell this person to do is make sure once you start to, like, they would know, look out for it based on them as an individual of what it means to when they start to compensate with their respiratory mechanics, and then get them in a quadruped position. And what's interesting, just from like my perspective, is these people that whoever listening to this podcast, like, these people tend to be more like narrow infrasternal angles individuals, and these people have like anterior compression of their thorax a lot of the times, like that forward head posture, thoracic extension, blah blah blah. But getting them in that quadruped position is so beneficial because the gravity is pushing down on them, which is allowing for, because air is a gas that follows the path of least resistance, to expand that anterior ribcage. I've seen so many cool things happen because of that specific sort of intervention. Can you expand upon that a little bit more just from your perspective?
Yeah, so I think I know specifically what training protocol you're talking about. It's one of those extended repeat desaturation pieces. So to give people some context, what we're trying to do here is we're taking, you could do it running, rowing, doesn't matter the modality. To give a rough estimate, if you were doing it running, you would do it 5 to 10 seconds faster than your mile PR pace. If you're rowing, you would do faster than your 2K pace. So you're over your VO2 max pace. And essentially you would hold this fast pace and keep holding it until you either can't coordinate your breathing anymore. Mm-hmm. Your heart rate starts spiking exponentially at some point, your mechanics start to compensate, like you're rowing and it looks like you're trying to bite your ear because your head's flailing around. Like, all of these things are signs to shut it down. Then we're putting people in that quadruped position, and everything you said is on point. The other thing that I would add is the diaphragm acts as a major spinal stabilizer. Mm-hmm. So when you're putting someone in that position, the diaphragm's not working to stabilize the spine anymore. So you're able to prop someone up and they're able to just focus on the rib cage expansion and breathing. That allows people to continue hyperventilating when they're not under axial load. And then they could continue to breathe off that CO2 and get back down to baseline during that rest period.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I love that. That's really cool. I'm playing around with this more and more, and I'm starting to see like things really start to click. Obviously, like, I'm not a pro at this at all, but I just think it's so cool to, because everything makes sense once you start to think about like all these different things. Like, people use different language for these things, but we're all kind of talking about the same thing. And the other end of the spectrum would be someone who compresses easily, and they sort of like I'm one of these people, and I know like you can expand upon this a lot more than I can, but we're someone that likes to occlude quite easily in the process, and that's our limitation. What are those people like?
Yeah, so these are individuals, a really simplified way of thinking about this is, actually, let's take it outside of exercise first. So imagine we both sit down in the chair right now and we put a big blood pressure cuff around our upper thigh and we just start pumping it up and we want to see how many millimeters of mercury we could pump this cuff up to until it cuts off our arterial blood flow. So remember, for like people listening, blood leaves the heart, goes through the arteries, gets to the muscle, comes back through the veins. So if you cut off arterial blood flow, nothing's getting in, nothing's getting out. This is typically a lot of pressure that's required. And the point at which you occlude the artery is when your cardiac output could no longer increase enough to push against that manual pressure that you're putting on the muscle. So if someone has very low cardiac output, their heart's not capable of pumping against that pressure gradient, they might get complete arterial occlusion at 175 millimeters of mercury. If someone has a heart like a horse or like a Tour de France cyclist, it might not occlude their artery until 360 millimeters of mercury of pressure. So when we're talking about delivering limited athletes, obviously that's a very limited in scope example, but something similar applies when we're doing exercise. But when we're exercising, it's not that we're manually inflating cuffs and sticking them around our limbs. Our muscular tension that we're generating to perform these movements is creating a certain amount of pressure in the muscle. And if that amount of pressure is greater than what your heart could pump against, then you're going to cut off blood flow to that limb. And it could either be a venous occlusion, which means it's an intermediate amount of pressure. Blood could get into the muscle, but it can't escape. Or it could be so much pressure that you can't even get blood into the muscle. And that's where you're really getting into deep water. Mm-hmm. So for these individuals, we have to ask, like, why is this happening in the first place? This could be related to breathing. If we go back to those examples of people who don't have good breathing mechanics or have kind of like wacky posture, for these individuals, their thoracic pump isn't working properly. The thoracic pump is what links the cardiovascular and pulmonary system. So if we're breathing with a nice full inhale and a nice full exhale and we're in a good position, our central driving pressures are going to be such that we're pushing blood back to the heart and venous return is happening effectively. But if you don't know how to breathe properly, you're going to impact your venous return, so less blood is getting back to your heart. And we could think of the circulatory system like a big closed loop. The same blood that leaves your heart is the blood that needs to get back to your heart. So if less blood's getting back to your heart, less blood's going to subsequently leave your heart. It becomes a vicious circle. The same thing could happen if someone has poor muscular coordination. They might be really good at contracting the muscle with a lot of force, but if they can't relax the muscle, blood is going to get trapped in that muscle, and it's also not going to get back to the heart. It's a coordination issue. It could also be that someone's very strong, but they have poor cardiac output relative to that, which is fine if you're a bodybuilder or power lifter. But if you're a field sport athlete, it's like, well, what's the point of being that strong if it's at the expense of being able to get blood back to your heart? So for all of these different processes, there are so many different reasons why they could occur. So I really like to think about it from like an integrated physiology standpoint. And I love what you said before that, like, tons of us are talking about these same things. We just use different language. Like, you could go to a dozen different courses or certifications, and it's like all just giving you pieces of the puzzle. And I like what you do, which is taking the big picture and just trying to like pull from these different places, like Bruce Lee used to talk about, and then you could kind of get a better idea of what's going on.
Yeah, man. I appreciate that. How would you know, just if you didn't have technology, what would be an indication that someone is biased towards a delivery limitation?
Yeah, so this is one of those things where I'll say that this is a crude way of knowing it, because this doesn't necessarily mean someone has a delivery limitation, but like, I work with a lot of CrossFitters, so a lot of times you'll hear these certain athletes, and no matter what workout they do, they always say the same thing when they fail, which is like, I had such a big muscle pump and like, I just couldn't go anymore. Like, I got pumped out. You see the same thing with a lot of climbers. They're like, my forearms got pumped out. That's a delivery limitation. You're getting blood trapped in the muscle and all of it's pooling. The reason that you feel that pump is because it's a venous occlusion issue. So whether that's muscular coordination is the problem, or cardiac output's the problem, or breathing's the problem, ultimately the cardiovascular system is the weak link in the chain there. So that's probably the quickest and easiest way, where like, for myself as an athlete, I've never failed on any workout as a CrossFitter or as a runner because I got pumped. Like, that sensation doesn't exist to me. So you could kind of parse things out that way a little bit.
Yeah. I think one thing you told me that was really helpful, just in terms of like a very I guess it's kind of subjective, but it helps me explain it to other people in terms of like, just like the tension you feel in your muscle when you poke it. Like me, I'm someone, you poke my bicep and there's like for sure some tension there. But if you poke other people and they're kind of like jelly relative to what I would be, is that an indication someone who's more stiff is probably more likely to be a delivery limitation?
Yeah, for sure. Someone that carries that higher resting muscle tension. I have a friend who's a really good manual therapist. And one of the things that he's mentioned, working with a lot of the top CrossFit Games athletes, mind you, these aren't people that are like pretty soft. Like they look super jacked, but he's like the best CrossFit Games athletes. Like they feel like cats. Like if you've ever picked up a kitten, like you pick them up and they're just like a Ziploc bag filled with water. Like they have no muscle tension. They're just like super Gumby-like. Yeah. That's what those CrossFit Games athletes' muscle tension feels like. He's like, you poke them in the bicep or you poke them in the quad, and he's like, there's no give whatsoever. You just like go right through them. But then they could ramp it up and they have that sympathetic drive to like lift those very heavy weights, where some back of the pack games competitors, they tend to carry a lot more muscle tension, and that ends up impeding their blood flow in a lot of the workouts they're doing. They're the ones that when they do a Metcon, they just get pumped out. The best CrossFit Games competitors don't get pumped out when they do Metcons. They have steady blood flow to the working muscles.
Yeah. Do you think that's something that can change? Like for me, I've spent most of my adult life like lifting heavy weights, not doing a ton of energy system stuff, and I'm stiff as a brick. So how much do you think, and obviously there's no real answer that we can know, but how much do you think it's possible to change my resting muscle tone?
So what I will say is I think it is adaptable to an extent. But I think what makes it difficult is like, I know a really good way to get you a very low tension. That's just to get you to stop lifting weights and use a lot of muscle. It's like problem solved. So the difficulty is like, the real question is, how do we get that to happen while you're still getting stronger and while you're still improving strength and power metrics? I think most people could do that to an extent, but I really do think that the gift of the best CrossFitters in the world is that they're able to like swing so far in one direction, then so far back in the other direction. They're so malleable. Like some of these athletes, to put in perspective, they're power cleaning. They're cleaning like 375, 385 pounds. They have respectable strength metrics, but they still have that low resting muscle tension. And I think that's something that you're just not going to train into someone.
Or if it is
something that you could train, maybe we're just missing the mark and someone knows how to do it. Maybe some special Tai Chi or something.
That's a great point. A lot of it's probably just genetically driven to what gifts they have as an athlete and things like that. But in terms of something that I personally am working on with my own programming is integrating this type of like an approach with periodizing with weight training, I guess is the best way to say it. Let's take someone who's delivery limited, for example, someone who's like pretty stiff. And how would you integrate weight training sessions with also giving them the energy system development stimulus they need that's individual to them? How would you integrate that throughout the course of like, I don't know, a mesocycle or something like that?
Yeah, for sure. So let's take two examples. Let's say we have a delivery limited athlete who actually needs to get stronger. And then we have the delivery limited athlete who doesn't need to get stronger, because these are two very different scenarios. The former is the one that I'm like, oh God, no, delivery limited athlete that needs to gain strength. That's something that we have to be very strategic with, because we're really going to have to do a good job of manipulating their muscle tension from day to day. So for these athletes, doing heavy strength training, the things that are going to get them stronger are also going to ramp their muscle tension up, which is the bane of trying to improve the relationship between their oxygen delivery and oxygen utilization in the muscles. So we have a few different options here. One could be, we could think about it from like a muscle spindle standpoint, which the, let me think of how to explain this. So mechanotransduction is the process of turning mechanical stimuli into chemical signals. And that's going to feed to our muscle spindles, which are going to determine the proper amount of length and tension in a bundle of muscle fibers. And for any given activity, there's going to be an appropriate amount of length and an appropriate amount of tension. So if we're doing a 10K run, it's like thousands and thousands of these light low-level contractions, versus if we're doing a one rep max back squat, it's just one maximal force contraction. We're going to need different amounts of length and tension in the muscle for both of those activities. So if you're doing your heavy strength training, you're pushing someone towards the ladder, like a great ability to produce a lot of force, but not a lot of length. where if you want someone to get better at this endurance activity, it's the opposite. So one way to do this is to stack train in a way that maybe you start their session with the strength training, then you figure out the appropriate dose of training that will lower their muscle tension. So it has the net effect of being like a neutral impact on tension or lowering impact on tension. You could even, you could do that thing a single day. You could do that as like an AM, PM, or you could do that across a set of days. And that's something that's really common in not all segments of track and field, but let's say at middle distance runners, a lot of their training, if you look at historically, like the way that the Ethiopians run, a lot of it is based on tension management. Mm. You'll see a lot of the Ethiopian runners, every time they do a really long run, they'll always do sprint work after it, or they'll do like ballistic and power work. And it's not always explained through this lens, but what that's doing is you're giving them this tension lowering stimulus, but then you're ramping tension back up at the end of that session. So they're getting the cardiovascular adaptations from that long run, but it's having more of a net neutral impact on tension. So then the next day when they come in for their speed training, they're not coming in flat for that session. So that's one way that we could handle it. But then for that delivery limited athlete who they're already kind of strong enough, that's where I would start focusing on coordination a little bit more than absolute strength. So when I say coordination, I'm specifically thinking about how quickly they could relax the muscle versus how quickly they could contract the muscle. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, from like a late stage intermediate to a world-class athlete, contraction speeds aren't that different, but relaxation speeds are far faster than that elite athlete. In at the world-class level, people could relax the muscle faster than they could contract it, which most individuals, that's not the case. You relax at a slower rate. And this is the case of like a very good sprinter. They're going to contract hard and they're probably going to cut off blood flow every time their foot makes contact with the ground. But if they could relax that muscle, they could get blood back out and back to their heart. So they're going to be able to maintain their cardiac output and they're going to have better fatigue resistance. So depending on which of those populations, we could decide what kind of protocols are going to make sense for that person.
That was a great explanation. How would you measure the contract and relax ratio? And how would you go about intervening and training that?
So the speed of contraction relaxation, we're not going to have a practical way of doing that unless you want to shell out like 250 grand.
Yeah.
But the downstream effects of that are something we can measure with NEARS or with MOXIE. We could see if athletes are venous occluding and not getting blood to escape the muscle between contractions. Mm. So we're not necessarily measuring those contraction speeds, but we're measuring the net effect of are they fully relaxing or are they not fully relaxing between contractions, and we could see that play out.
Gotcha. So if you saw, let's say I had a MOXIE device on my quad, so what you would probably see in the case of someone who's stiff like me, you would see occlusion happen and that occlusion would stay as opposed to that occlusion dipping down.
Yeah, so I've actually got this really nice case study from two pretty competitive CrossFitters where they're both doing, they're doing 20 squat cleans at 225 pounds per time. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the first five reps, they both do the first five reps in the exact same speed. And then one of these athletes ends up maintaining that speed through all 20 reps and the other one completely falls off. And I have their NEARS trends, and you see the guy that maintains his speed across all the reps, he gets venous occlusion on every single rep, but you see blood come down to baseline levels between every rep, and he just keeps repeating it over and over and over. It's like contract, relax, the other guy, he gets a venous occlusion on the first rep, and all that blood doesn't leave the muscle, like 50% of it escapes the muscle, then he does the next rep, occludes again, a little bit less escapes the muscle. So you see the staircasing effect where more and more blood is getting trapped in the muscle. And after five or six reps, he just has to take a break because now there's so much blood trapped in the muscle and so much metabolic stress that he's kind of toasted. And he ends up just struggling through the last 14, 15 reps.
That makes sense. So in terms of making that person better at not occluding and staying occluded, maybe training them in terms of like your model as if they're delivery limited would be a good way to go and intervene?
Yeah, I train as if they're delivery limited, and that's where you can start to get into some coordination protocols. Like one of the things that I love, it's not always accessible, would be like a K-box, which allows athletes to train to absorb and redirect force really effectively. So it's essentially a device that you concentrically do a movement and it tries to suck you back into the machine eccentrically with a little bit more force than you produced. And for anyone who's used a K-box, like if your coordination is off, like it's going to freaking suck. Like you don't relax fully at the top of the squat and it's just going to like jerk you back down. or at the bottom when you're transitioning from the eccentric back into the concentric, if you misgroove it, it's also going to like jerk you and pull you at the bottom. So athletes start to get very good at figuring out how to relax the muscle and redistribute force effectively, because it really forces your hand to the fire to do that. There's That's obviously, awesome. Yeah, there's like other ways of doing it as well. Like I know like Cal Dietz's protocols, like the triphasic system and oscillating isometrics and all these things are effective ways of doing that as well. And that would be a way of doing it and not spending a bunch of money on something like a K-box.
Yeah, that's actually really cool. I do like those. Yeah, the oscillation isometrics, those are sweet. Is there anything else that comes to mind with that?
You know, non-specific to like squatting or anything like that, but if you look at the way that the best sprinters in the world train, these protocols are all built into their training, like reactive strength drills and contact strength drills. Like I know Altus, if you look at a lot of their like sprint library, I don't know if they specifically specify these protocols in that way, but it's the same concepts, just different exercises being used for sport specific applications. So I think a lot of people, again, they're all doing the same thing. They might explain it a different way, but I think we're all kind of hitting on the same idea, and you see it in a lot of successful sport disciplines or schools.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that explanation. If you wouldn't mind, I wanted to get into a couple of Q&A questions.
Yeah, for sure.
So I proposed this just to Instagram. Like I picked the three best questions. So Oscar asks, what are the most common mistakes team sport coaches or strength and conditioning coaches make in a sport like soccer, for example, in regards to energy system training?
Okay. I think one of the big ones that come to mind is not having a consideration for the impact of injuries on energetics. So one of the things that I see, I've done a lot of consulting with teams, and I always have like a few guys on the team that are there like lazy guys, is how the coaches usually talk about them. And when you start getting either MOXIE or thermography data on these guys, you see that they actually have what we call hypothermic asymmetries in their tissues. They have areas like poor perfusion or like disrupted fiber structures in their tissue. And typically when, particularly when you're working at like a high school level or like a college level, a lot of times these are the athletes the coaches are always like punishing with more conditioning work because they need to get fitter. And when you start looking at these guys' trends, you're like, hey, they're not lazy. Like they literally have like muscle pathologies that are preventing them from getting the adaptation that you want to. So for these individuals, like, I don't care how much you hit them with like HIIT work or like LSD training, none of it's going to get the adaptation. And that's something that's obviously not across the board in team sports. A lot of professional sport teams that I've talked to, they're implementing these technologies as well. But I think that's a really big one that I see. I think the other one is just a fundamental misunderstanding of energy systems. Like a lot of coaches, they'll talk about like alactic anaerobic power and lactic endurance and all of these things. And I think just the fundamental understanding that everything is aerobic and everything is lactic could really shift how people think about energy system training and give them some more practical ways to identify limiters.
I hear you. One of the coolest things I still talk about to people all the time in your courses, when you showed me this case study of there was some athlete recovering from like a knee injury. I don't remember what it was, but it was something significant.
Yeah, it's a left ACL rupture.
Yeah. And then do you want to describe the NEARS trends on the isometric split squat? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so I know exactly what one you're talking about. So at the time of this test, we had this guy doing isometric split squat holds on both sides. So forward leg is the dominant working leg. Trail leg is the supposed to be stabilizing leg. This guy, I think about 6-9 months post-op at this point, I can't remember exactly, but we had MOXIEs on both of his quads and we were looking at blood flow trends and oxygen utilization trends in the muscle. And at this point in his rehab, his previously injured leg was overworking on everything. It was just like lagging. So on his right leg, we would see on the primary working legs, he would create a ton of tension in that quad. He would get a lot of oxygen utilization. But then when the right leg was the trail stabilizing leg, you're like, oh, nothing's really happening. Like little baby amount of tension, very little oxygen utilization. Then on the left leg, we see that on every single set. When it's the working leg, you see a ton of tension. When it's the stabilizing leg, you see a ton of tension. Yeah. So as coaches, like I even asked this athlete, I'm like, how did these sets feel? And they're like, oh, everything felt great. I held a minute and a half at this load on all the sets. And I'm like, God, this guy did double the amount of volume on his left leg than his right leg because every set's a working set. And that's something that if we allowed that to perpetuate out a few weeks, we probably would have re-injured his knee. Thankfully, we caught it early, but those are the kinds of things that you see in these return to play processes that are always interesting because this guy works with pro sport teams. So he's like cleared to play. He has a unilateral strength balance, but you still see these bioenergetic discrepancies between sides.
That's so cool. I think that's such an interesting and just sort of like, I don't even know, it's like novel thing to think about when it comes to, because their biomechanics can be great. Everything, like mentally, they could be great. But if they have that restriction still in the bioenergetics, then that something could still be off. So how would you intervene in that if it's like a localized, like it's just their left quad sort of thing? How would you get them to not compress that quad on everything?
Yeah, so what I want to see is this is where we need to play a little bit more of a detective role because I want to know why that's happening. So ideally, I really like the combination of NIRS and a technology called thermography, which most people now because of COVID are probably familiar with. If you go to like Whole Foods, they have these giant thermal cameras in the front of the store. Yeah. That's exactly the same technology that we're using for a sports science application. And we're creating heat maps of the muscle and looking at side to side changes in the distribution of skin temperature. Mm-hmm. So we could essentially spot areas of poor perfusion in tissue, or we could spot signs of inflammation with varying degrees of severity based on the degree Celsius change from side to side. So what I'm always trying to understand with these athletes is like, okay, well, are they creating this compensation because the tissue is like a fiber disruption issue and they're hypothermic and their perfusion's crap? Or is the tissue inflamed and that's causing hemoglobin to dissociate from oxygen too readily? Mm. So depending on what the actual issue is for someone, that's going to entirely determine our approach. And one of the really weird things is during that return to play process, it's so temperamental and hit and miss that this guy might come in today and that's the issue. He mm-hmm. might come in tomorrow and there's no discrepancy. And there's almost no rhyme or reason why these things are happening, at least that we could parse out. So having these technologies, a lot of what I'm doing with people, honestly, is just stopping them from training certain qualities on certain days when we see the tissue isn't ready. We don't always have ways of changing it on that day. It's just like a red flag to like pump the brakes a little bit.
Gotcha. So if you, so like using that left quad example, if they were compressing all the time, you might not want to do like, you know, high volume bilateral squats or just like a ton of left split squats in that example, because you wouldn't want them to just keep putting volume on something that's going to compress really soon.
Yeah, for sure. And even earlier in his rehab phase, I think we might have talked about this at some point as well, he actually had the opposite issue when he was closer to like 2 or 3 months out from surgery, which is that previously injured side, the muscles in the quad weren't creating tension at all. So we would have him do rowing intervals and we would look at side to side blood flow trends and oxygen utilization trends. And we'd be like, God, like his left vastus lateralis and rec fem are doing like nothing during this activity. So that's a case where he was actually compensating using other muscles as the primary working muscles that really shouldn't be the primary working muscles on that leg. Yeah. And that opens up like a whole nother set of potential issues for the individual.
I see. So maybe like this might be getting down a rabbit hole, but like, let's just say, for example, like that pelvis on the left is in an anterior orientation. So the quad has more leverage to work. And if you were to maybe get that pelvis to get a little bit more variability, and this is just like the lens, I think, and like be able to get that hamstring or whatever, like maybe they need to get their like other posterior rotators of the pelvis. Maybe if that pelvis was in a slightly better position, is it potentially, could it be potentially causative in terms of, or having influence on having that quad compress less because it's not in a position to compress as much?
Yeah, and I think like potentially that's a plausible explanation. The thing is, it's like maybe that's the case for one guy, maybe it's not for the other. So this is where we get into like where I say these technologies don't always give us the right answers. They're kind of like clues so we can play detective. It's like, yeah, dude, try and fix it on that day and see what happens. Like sometimes you try manipulation and the tissue is able to utilize oxygen effectively. For some individuals, you'll try the same manipulation, you don't get anything. So I think it's this process of like model building and induction where you're seeing more scenarios, you're trying different applications in live time, and you're seeing what ends up working until you could build up like a repertoire of like an algorithm that you could run a situation through and figure out what the right decision to make is. But I mean, at this point, I have some other coaches that I'm collaborating with on this that work with pro sport teams or work with the military. And I just think we're still so early into this process that we don't have all the answers yet.
That's cool. That, I mean, like, it's cool you're willing to admit that, but also, like, you guys are onto something for sure. So I'm excited to see where that goes. One other question, or two more questions. Someone asks, thoughts on the 80-20 rule for endurance and thoughts on athletic neurotyping?
Okay, so I'll start with the 80-20 one. The neurotyping one, it's really odd that this came up because I literally had someone ask me about this 2 days ago. Wow. So it's such an odd coincidence. So the 80-20 principle is a rough heuristic. I like the idea of it, but one thing to start out with is that this isn't accurately... This is an issue of statistics. So for example, let's say we went to Death Valley, or I went to Death Valley, and you asked me what the temperature is like there. And I told you, oh, it's like 80 degrees. And I'm talking about the average temperature. So now you're going to Death Valley in a week from now, and you bring like shorts and a t-shirt and you go there. During the daytime, you're going to burn. It's like 120 degrees during the day. And during the nighttime, you're going to freeze because it drops down to 40 degrees. The average temperature there is 80. But it's never actually 80 degrees at any given point in the day. And I think this is the issue with these types of protocols. I'm sure you've probably heard the 10,000 hour rule as well. If you actually look at the raw data from those studies, no one actually trained for 10,000 hours in the world-class experts. The range was between 3,000 hours and like 16,000 hours. It averages out to 10,000. But it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of statistics. So when you look at elite endurance athletes training, yeah, it averages out to 80% of it being relatively easy, 20% being relatively hard. But that doesn't accurately reflect any given person. So I think if you were to just go rough heuristic, it's fine. But if we're saying, is that like a magic formula? I definitely don't think so. And this even gets into the limitations that we're talking about earlier, which is like, from my pedigree, middle distance running, there are these crazy debates over like, is low volume, high intensity the way to go for an 800 meter runner? Like, you don't train more than 20 miles per week because every mile is run at 100% effort. And you have guys like the Lydiard camp that they're like, hey, you have to train 100 plus miles per week, and all of it has to be above X minute per mile pace, and that's the way to train for an 800 meter. And the funny thing is, both of those approaches have produced world-class 800 meter runners. But I think if you were to take someone who's a world-class performer in one of those schools and put them into the other one, you're not going to get the same carryover. And the reason for that is someone who's limited by their rate of oxygen utilization is going to do really good with that high-intensity, low-volume approach. Someone who's limited by their rate of oxygen supply is going to do better with that other approach. Yeah. So I think the 80-20 rule, again, good heuristic, might not work for you as an individual, though, so buyer beware.
Yeah. That's a great explanation. And as for athletic neurotyping, can you just like tell us what that is and how it applies to your model?
Yeah, so the one thing that I will say is I think the science that it's based on is complete bullshit. So that's my starting point. The general idea is that you could get a proxy on what someone's neurotransmitter dominance is, and you could use that to effectively make decisions about how to train them. The one issue with this is that it's based on there's no mechanistic studies supporting this idea. There's no observational studies supporting this idea. And mechanistic and observational studies aren't even good forms of studies for doing this type of thing. So it's basically saying there's no justification because we can't measure these things. So like, how are you going to create a questionnaire that's 15 questions and it's going to tell me my neurotransmitter dominance when no one's had these things measured to draw correlations? That said, I think the general principle of trying to profile your athletes and understand their personalities is great. My personal issue is that like, we don't need to dress this up with the concept of neurotransmitter typing. Like, we just call it like, hey, this athlete's really driven, or you could just talk to someone and see what their personality is and understand how to treat them like a human being instead of trying to like, I mean, the neurotyping thing, it comes around every 3 to 4 years and it's a different person selling it. So it's very clearly one of those things, like, I don't know if you've ever heard of like the blood type diet. That was a big one.
Oh, yeah.
Start getting the training, it's like, oh, you're type A negative. This is how you need to eat. Like, your type O, this is how you have to eat, disappears because it's based on like no real science, but it's going to come back around like in 6 months from now. The blood type diet's going to be huge. I'll call it right now. I'm kind of joking, but it's the same idea. So again, like, I hate to be that guy that just like tries to tear apart concepts. I think the practical takeaways are great. Understand an athlete's personality and work with it. I just don't think we need to like justify with super sciencey sounding things that it just kind of cheapens it, you know?
I totally agree. Last question, Dave asks, what specific work to rest ratio ranges would be used for each of his model's three rate limiters?
Oh God, I have no idea. it's difficult because that's one of those things, like part of my point is that these things are so variable that there aren't really good heuristics. Like if I tell you to do a 20-second sprint at 75% of your max sprint speed and you desaturate down to 10%, it might take you 35 seconds to resaturate and do another interval. It might take another guy 2.5 minutes. And again, we could take population level averages, but in my experience, everyone just ends up getting misrepresented by those. So I really prefer to just talk about first principles, because any number that I throw out just isn't going to, it's not going to do anyone justice.
Yeah, that's totally fair. So the answer would be just like, look at this individual's limiters and then like what their trends are and figure it out from there.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool, man. Well, I appreciate it. That's all I had for you today. I appreciate you coming on, man. This was honestly one of the most fun and insightful podcasts I've done in quite some time. So I really appreciate it, Evan.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. And thank you for having me on. It was great chatting with you and catching up.
Likewise, man.